listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flueckiger, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome to today's show, LA Talk Radio, Your Ultimate Life. The show that I have been running now for years, focused on creating and helping you create purpose, prosperity and joy. Not with magic and not in a gold mine, but with what's in your life, your gifts, your skills, and your life experience. Today, I'm excited to have a special guest, Robbie Humble, who's got a really cool message and stuff. And so we're going to get to know him as we go through this. Robbie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Kellen.
Yeah, well, I'm excited about your message, your mission, and what you're about. And I don't do intro kind of stuff. It'll come out as we go.
Great.
But I want you to start with, tell me how Robbie, without, and you don't have to be modest, this is your chance because I'm asking, what does Robbie do on purpose to add love, to add good, to add growth to the world?
Well, first, I father intentionally on purpose. I have a 15-year-old son and a 12-year-old daughter. I'm divorced, so I only get them less than half the time. And when I have them, I make sure that I'm really focused on them. Of course, they're my children, so that's all about love. But I also apply this in my personal life beyond my children. I have a number of people in my life that I tell I love on an occasional on a regular basis. I believe that love is the most powerful force in the world, in the universe. And when applied to relationships and even business, love can be a very, very powerful force for good. And that would be the third area that I would highlight, Kellen, is I apply love in business. I'm CEO of a subsidiary of a publicly traded company. We have about 100 employees, and the companies have been around for over 30 years. And I joined as CEO less than a year ago. And in my first role as CEO, I've worked directly for CEOs for close to 20 years now. And I've seen it up close a lot of times. This is my first time in the seat. And my philosophy is leading through love. And so every day when I wake up and go to work, I'm thinking about love and how I can lead with love. And to be quite clear, Kellen, love in this circumstance for leadership is not soft. It's not sentimentality. It's certainly not romance. It's first having the courage to tell the truth and to be clear and having the courage to have hard discussions and having the courage as a leader to create safe spaces for other people to be courageous and speak their truth. So three areas of life, closest to me, my children, actively, intentionally loving them, others in my personal life that are close to me as well. And then at the professional level, I lead with love.
You know, somebody could hear that and, you know, we had a chance to visit before another time, and so I knew some things about you. And somebody could say, you know, here's some kind of a leftover hippie who thinks that, you know, love is the answer. Love is all you need, you know, and sing the Beatles song or hang around and sing Kumbaya.
Yeah.
So I know that's not what you mean, and I know that love is the binding force of the universe. And you can see that because love gathers and fear and hate disperse.
Yeah.
You know, light attracts and darkness pushes away. That's obvious in all created things. So tell me more about a couple of things. What does that look like? So let's get out of the philosophical and get to the day-to-day business of running a 100-person company that is been in business for a minute, 30 years is not trivial, and is providing value that people pay for, whatever it is. So what does it look like? Like you worked for a bunch of CEOs, compare and contrast a little bit. And you can be as specific as you need to be. And this is not about ragging on anybody, but I want you to paint a picture for the listeners about what that actually means so that they can have that experience. Because everybody's had a good boss and a jack wagon. So.
Yeah. Well, look, in practice, I'll start with a philosophical and then I'll get very specific for you. But in practice, it's about creating safety. And safety comes from truth. And safety also comes from trust, right? So very early on, I was focused on extending trust appropriately, but extending trust and telling the truth. And so one of the very first things that I did, in fact, it was in my very first week as CEO, we went fully remote as a workforce. We were already remote 3 days a week. And we had an opportunity to shed a lease and made the decision to go fully remote across the whole company, sending the message that I don't need you to be sitting in any particular seat for you to be present and productive. So that's one example of how I showed trust to the organization. Also, in my first month on the topic of truth and clarity, I showed a couple charts that showed our financial performance over the last couple of years. And it was a truth that was not, it was not a pleasant truth. But it was not a truth that had been shared with them. And so, you know, I shared that with them and committed to transparency. And so that's what we do. Every 6 weeks, I have a town hall where I talk about our priorities, how we're progressing towards them. And so transparency, communication, and truth telling are a big part of what it looks like on the ground. I got to give an example of an individual and how it's affected their lives though. And that's what's been coolest about all this, Kellen, is, it's not just soft. It's not just hippy dippy stuff. We are driving real performance. A company that was flat for years is now delivering double digit year over year growth, every single month for the last, 8 months now. And that started literally 2 months after I came on with my team. And so we're driving financial performance. Your question was, what does it look like in specifics? We're also driving better outcomes for the humans that work for us and work with us. So one example is an individual who's been with us for 25 years. She was kind of the do-it-all project manager. Everything that nobody else wanted to do, she kind of did. And we put her in a new role. We shed a lot of the work that she was doing previously that didn't need to be done or could be done somewhere else. We gave her a tremendous amount of purpose. So that's another big part of this, Kellen, is imbuing the organization with purpose. That's bigger than just the day-to-day job. And we gave her a significant amount of purpose. We said, you're going to build a product portfolio that our company will stand on for years to come. And so she got into this job. She was enjoying it. She was doing really well. And we had a call one day a few months ago. And she just shares, you know, I've always lost sleep at this company. I've been here for 25 years. She said it used to be because I couldn't sleep on Sunday nights because the dread in the pit of my stomach. She said, now I have trouble sleeping every night of the week because I'm so excited about what I get to do tomorrow. And that's what it's all about, Kellen, is, and I've had a number of other people say that leading this way is not only delivering double-digit year-over-year revenue growth, it's also changing the way that they show up with their families. It's changing the way that they show up with their spouses, in their communities, in their churches. By leading this way, we can not only deliver incredible financial performance because it unlocks. We didn't have any new products, any new services, no new marketing, no new sales tactics, literally just a different kind of leadership unlocked double-digit sales growth. And I've had a number of people come and tell me that it's changed their lives. And so that's why I'm here, Kellen. That's what has gotten me so excited about what we're doing at my company. And I want to tell people about it.
So that's wonderful. And I believe you wholeheartedly. I'd like to ask a specific question, and you've given some answers already. You demonstrated trust by allowing people to go fully remote. And, you know, in the old school, when remote work was just starting, and, you know, I'm old enough to be old school, you know, the idea was, well, if they're not at work, they're going to be dorking around and nobody's going to do anything and you're not going to get any performance and it's all just fake. And clearly that's not happening. Clearly there's a responsiveness to that trust. Clearly your choice to give a purposeful bent or purposeful entire suite, get rid of a bunch of stuff and take advantage of 25 years worth of experience and to do a meaningful thing in terms of product portfolio creation, did something. Tell me about, was there skepticism? Was there any withholding? Was there like, because someone could say, well, you got lucky, or, well, you must have a bunch of weirdos working for you or whatever. And I don't believe that's true. I believe you had a cross section of whatever and that it can be done. So the question's two part. Tell me about some of the implementation process. And the thing that's most important to me is, one person, like you're the CEO and you commit, we're going to do this. And when you're in charge, you get to do that kind of thing. What about someone that hears this show, is in love with your idea and said, yeah, I could do something if I didn't have such a jerk for a boss or a company or whatever. And that's a lame excuse. So tell us about your implementation process and then talk about what a person might do in their own life all alone with things they are responsible for, instead of trying to have the universe order itself around their ideas.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to answer your question, but first I'm going to say, you know, I work inside a publicly traded company. We have investors, we have a board. I'm not any different from those folks. I happen to have a support structure above me, a governance structure that is supportive, but this can happen in publicly traded companies, on teams at the highest level and inside. So the first thing as a leader in terms of process, you got to get the right people. And this is going to be similar to a lot of other advice you get, but made some hard decisions early on, both around letting go, and because not everybody is gonna fit the mold, right? And so you've got to make sure you've got people, particularly at the top, that are gonna lead. And so if this is within a team, you know, within a company, maybe not the top team, if you want to lead with love, you need to have leaders under you that also lead with love. And that means knowing how to create these safe spaces. Love is also, by the way, and so part of the process is developing accountability. So it's not just unicorns and rainbows. Like, we have very high standards. We hold ourselves to those standards. And we are in a very high pressure environment. So it can happen anywhere. For the individual who is working within a company and doesn't have the power to change everything. And I'll note, not even CEOs have the power to change everything. You got to move hearts and minds, right? You can't just...
you do. And that's an interesting thing that people won't understand, but I get it. So yes.
it's not as easy as it may seem. But, you know, Kel and I have developed a leadership model that can apply to anyone at any level. And it goes by an acronym called CALM. So this is what I follow. I've published this in a book that'll be coming out shortly. But it's an acronym called CALM. And it starts with centering yourself. So the C stands for center yourself. And that means that as a leader, everything starts with you. You gotta do the work to be healthy, to have a regulated nervous system, a well-regulated nervous system. Basically, that means an inner peace, inner calm, right? And you have to know where you act from. So when you get angry, understanding why you get angry, when you get anxious, when you get happy, when you celebrate, when you feel like you want to punish. Understanding where those things come from is the first step in being able to lead. It's really being able to lead yourself. So that's the C. The A is attuned to others. So once you've quieted the noise inside, you can then attune to others. You can understand where they're coming from, what their motivations are, why they do the things that they do. And if you have an inner calm yourself, you can actually transmit that as a leader to the people in your proximity. One-on-one conversations, small group meetings, those are places where you can really attune to other humans and have a direct impact by the way that you show up on them. And we all know this, right? A boss walks into an office and slams the door so that the windows rattle. That's going to be a very different meeting from the boss walking into the office and telling a joke, right? You get two very different energies from that. And so we know that the way that we show up as leaders affects the room. And so it starts with ourselves, then attuning to others. Then the L is in the CALM acronym is lead with steadiness. And so then we start to get into the hard-nosed business things, right? So we get clarity, we set a vision, we put in place infrastructure, processes, systems to be able to deliver on that vision, and then we put in place accountability and standards, and it all ties together, right? So the standards tie into the infrastructure and the processes you've built, which tie up to the vision that you've established as a leader of the organization. And you can do this again at any scale, right? You don't have to be the leader of a company to have a vision for what your organization, your part of the organization, is going to accomplish. And then the last one is M, so to complete the acronym CALM. And M stands for make meaning. And when you make meaning, you give a higher purpose to what people are doing every day. So they're not just answering the call and answering calls all day and adjudicating auto claims, which is what my company does. You're contributing as an employee of my company to keeping a vehicle operational for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of customers who may have a vehicle as their only source of transportation to their livelihood. And so we imbue the organization with purpose. We help them understand the higher order vision. And when you really enroll people into that greater mission, you start to have them self-select into accountability, and they understand why the standards exist. And so, again, this can be done at any level. It can be done as a CEO. It can be done as a manager, mid-level. Center yourself, attune to others, lead with steadiness, and make meaning.
So that's fabulous. And I followed it all the way through. I'm going to change the topic here for a minute.
Okay.
Tell me about that piano.
That is my Yamaha Baby Grand. I love to play. I also sing. And so I play probably an hour or two a day and sing. I'm not like you, Kellen. I don't write my own music, but I really enjoy playing by chords, playing off music, and like I said, I'm a singer.
Why did you pick a Yamaha?
Because I couldn't afford a Steinway. I couldn't justify a Steinway.
Which model is that?
Yamahas are great pianos, and good eyes that you could see that.
Spectacular piano. What size is it? Is it the 6 foot or the 7 foot six? Or
it's
what is
a 6 foot. Yeah.
6 foot. Yeah. Well, that's glorious. So I love the fact that you're in music, and all the more power in love. And what I do or don't do doesn't matter, but I love the fact that you do that. And I'm glad that that was in the background. It moves, it makes me feel warm and mushy just because of that.
And yeah, well, we share that.
We do share that. And, you know, I have a story. My first studio piano, I've run a recording studio for many years. My first studio piano was a Yamaha, a 7 foot six, this Yamaha C7, which is beautiful. And I used it for many years. And then lo and behold, I did have the opportunity to have a Steinway D9, 9 foot grand for 20 years. Finally, when we moved Yeah. And so I used to, and this is the thing, and this you can tie into your leadership practices. So I have a Steinway 9 foot, and I had it for 20 years, and I would practice sometimes a little and sometimes 3 or 4 hours a day and played a lot, whatever. And it got to be where, oh, I got to practice. And one day I thought, I have a Steinway 9 foot grand in the living room, and I say, I have to practice. That is the stupidest thing I ever heard. There's people that would love all their lives to just play on one.
Right.
And oh, what a moron. And so the way that that ties in for me is we have so many opportunities around us. And you've given a good explanation of your children and your circle of loved ones. And you include in your circle of loved ones your employees. And by extension, the customers that you serve. Am I being weird?
No, not for me.
Okay, good. So tell me about your book.
Yeah, it's called Love and Leadership. And the subtitle is Cultivating Authority Without Fear. And it essentially asserts that the dominant paradigm in business leadership today, and this is true in government as well, is based upon fear. And for good reason. Fear works. It gets compliance. It gets performance. We have fear built into our incentive structures. We have fear built into our the infrastructure itself. I can fire you if I want to. And I have a journey, moving through that system. And, the book is really, it's about 80% memoir where I walk you through various points in my career that were meaningfully, challenging for the most part, actually are the areas that I talk most about, because those are the areas that are most revealing and the areas where we experience the most growth. And so I walk through moments of my career moving through this system of fear. And I talk about how I excel in that system. I put on a mask of performance. I pretend that everything's okay when on the inside, for many of the last 20 years, I was succeeding on the outside. And on the inside, I was anxious and on more than one occasion had very real breakdowns. We're talking curling on the sofa in a ball, rocking back and forth, crying kind of breakdowns. And that's what this system does to people, particularly high performers. And so I share that story. And I think a lot of readers of the book are really going to see themselves in this story. And I talk about these trials. I talk about the various components of my career that really formed me. I talk about leaving corporate. So I spent most of my career wanting to earn enough money that I could retire by 50 and never have to work again. Well, I got impatient, and at 40, I left corporate. I wanted to make myself a CEO, and I started a business. To make a really long story short, a year later, that business was failing. I'd lost over $400,000 and I was in a ball on the sofa crying. And I made the fateful decision to sell that business. This is all shared in the book. And then I returned back to corporate America as a CEO. I was determined that I wanted to come back as a CEO so I could implement these theories that I developed after 20 years of working directly for CEOs. And I was given that opportunity a year ago, as I've shared, and the incredible financial performance that we've seen and the change in lives that we've seen was so inspiring to me that I had to share it with the world. And I've done so in a book. It's been the most rewarding experience and in many ways, the most challenging experience of my life, because it causes you to pause and reflect. And as a result of that reflection, I now have a leadership model that I articulated to you that's in black and white. It's actionable. And it's really important, I think, to note that most leadership books are about doing. This book is about being. So my argument is that one leader or two leaders can say and do the exact same things and get vastly different results. And yet a lot of our leadership books today are all about doing, not about who you are as a leader when you show up. And that's what my book's all about, is how do you show up as a leader? How do you calm yourself to the extent that you can, you know, I believe the nervous system of a company mimics the nervous system of the leader. And that's really what this book is about, is helping you understand how I got to that conclusion by walking through my career. And then very specifically articulating it at the end of the book as something that you can implement and use in your own life.
Being people, some people are going to understand that because I talk about that a lot when I do solo episodes, but some people are going to not understand what that means compared to doing. I mean, like if I don't do stuff, I don't get paid for just standing there. And in fact, you do. I mean, that how you show up, and that is so powerful. You just gave an example. A boss walks in and slams the door or drops something on the table hard or huffs or walks in and greets somebody joyfully. Those are reflections of being. And the interesting thing is a lot of people think you can pretend you're being, you can be performative. So I can go in and tell a joke, even though I'm not okay. And I'm not being, my energy is not congruent with the action. And so people think that you can pretend that. I want you to talk for a minute about why that's not true and what leaks when you're performing being.
Well, look, we're animals at the end of the day, right? We're highly sophisticated animals with languages and various ways of expressing ourselves. But at the end of the day, we still have animal instincts. And people can sense if you're stressed. People can sense if you're angry. They can sense if your smile, you know, a lot of times the smile doesn't reach the eyes, right?
That's true.
It's just at the mouth. And so I have a belief that I think is backed by science. We are animals, and we can sense the internal state of others. And so it's not about faking it. I did that for 20 years. And I really struggled as a leader in many ways because of that. And so and I'll also admit, Kellen, that this is a journey, right? Like I'm not perfect. This book was written for me, right? Because I needed this book. I needed to be educated on how to regulate myself. Because I do believe deeply that the energy that I put off, and again, that energy is palpable. We can, you went through a number of examples. The energy that you give off has a direct impact on the energy, the nervous system. There are lots of different words you can use: anxiety, joy, lots of different emotions. But the way that I show up in a room, no matter what I say, no matter what I do, people will sense if I'm afraid, for example. Which, by the way, Kellen, I think this is another kind of to-do or practical thing that we do. We acknowledge that in our meetings. I know a lot of the teams that are deeper in my organization have adopted this same practice that we use at my leadership team level. We start every single meeting with the question, what are you bringing to the meeting? And that gives each member of the meeting an opportunity to talk about, you know, sometimes you had a great weekend filled with lots of fun things. Sometimes you had a tragedy in your family. Sometimes you're really excited about what's coming up with work in the coming weeks. Sometimes you're really anxious about it. Sometimes you're feeling overwhelmed. And so we just talk about it. We put it on the table. And again, that's the A, attuning to others, right? It's creating a space where people can show up as themselves and not have to pretend that everything is okay. It's okay for everything not to be okay. And as leaders, we need to create spaces for everything to not be okay. And yet still the standards apply. We will still hold ourselves accountable to performance, but we're going to do it as a team, not by ourselves at 3 a.m, lying awake in bed, worrying about the next day, which I have done countless times in my career.
You know, I want people to listen to this. Sometimes on these shows, we talk fast and we say a lot of stuff, and sometimes we slow down. And this is a slow down moment, because the truth, what you're saying, is the truth carries its own power. And if the truth of our being is something different than we're acting, the truth carries its own power and permeates all of the fields of others. And we don't really know how those receptors are, the energetic jazz. And we also know that our energy affects probabilities. And, you know, when we talk about creating our future, that's all real and physics based. And just because we don't know how it works doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And so it's right. Absolutely, absolutely true. And I'm so excited that you've got this example that you can freely share. Why do you suppose, if 80% of the book is talking about Robbie and your ups and downs, and what people don't know that I know about you, you had 20 years. Tell us a little bit about your career, and then I'll get back to the question.
Yeah.
You graduated from who? Like, give me a little bit of who are you now?
Yeah, well, I always have to start with, I'm a small town boy from Oklahoma. I grew up in rural Oklahoma, and left that small town to go to WashU in St. Louis. It's at the time a top 10 engineering school. I studied mechanical engineering there. Graduated magna cum laude, so graduated in the top 10% of my engineering class. My very first job out of business school, I was managing 50 people. I was 23 years old and had a dotted line to the CEO of the company because I was in a leadership development program. And so I started very, very quickly managing, like I said, 50 people, many of whom were my parents' age. And then I did that for a couple of years. It was a leadership development program, so I did a number of different roles. And then I went to Harvard Business School. I got my MBA at Harvard, went full-time for 2 years, graduated from there, and was committed to the path of becoming a CEO. One thing I want to mention, when I was at Harvard, a gentleman named Clay Christensen, who coined the term disruption in the 1990s, he was one of my professors and he had brain cancer and they thought he was going to die. And so he gave a speech to my graduating class. And one of the things he said was, management is the noblest of professions. And he said, if you want to do good in the world, be in management, because it has a more profound impact on the lives of the people in the company and the people in their lives than almost anyone else in your employees' lives. And so from that point on, graduating from Harvard, I wanted to be a CEO because I wanted to be able to lead and influence. And I conducted my career accordingly. I had the philosophy that I wanted to see every single business model I could. I've worked in business to government. I've worked in business to business, business to consumer, business to business to consumer, and direct to consumer. So I've done them all. I've worked in every single function except for IT and HR. My career was always kind of progressively moving up and to the right until I left to start a business. But I was always in a leadership development program, or I was head of strategy, head of M&A. And so literally for my entire 20-year career, I had a front row seat to the C-suite. And for over 10 of those years, I was head of strategy. And so I created the agendas for all the strategic meetings, including the weekly meetings of the CEOs I worked with, and got a front row seat in many ways to leadership. And so I'm not a hippie. You know, I'm not even a coach or a consultant. I worked inside organizations. I've worked in publicly traded companies, private equity owned companies, entrepreneurial companies. I designed my whole career to be a CEO that could operate in any set of circumstances, whatever the industry might be, whatever the go-to-market strategy might be. And through those experiences, I had those triumphs, many of them, but I also had emotional difficulties at many times because of the mask I had to put on and the fear that I had to endure while at work. And then not necessarily even by my leaders, right? There's so many good people, good leaders that are in this system of fear. And I've worked directly for a number of really, really good leaders. But there's still, you know, it's a system of fear. And so that's where I am in my career now, is I'm leading in a different way. We're performing well. And, you know, the team is incredibly motivated and excited. And I don't think I could have really, it took 20 years and ultimately writing a book to really, I think, bring all of this to fruition. But it's been one heck of a ride. Lots of successes, lots of lessons. And I'm young, right? I'm only 42. So I've got a long way to go.
Yeah, you do. You do. I mean, spoken from me, I got kids older than you, dude. So I do. My oldest boy is 45. He'll be 46 this year. So I got kids older than you. Anyway, so I wanted you to give the commercial about going to the schools, prestigious things, and working in C-suite things and in those prestigious positions with an intentionally focused design from inside this structure of fear-based stuff that we really do have. Now, you made the comment, gee, I worked for some really good people. I believe you. You're a really good person. And you knew it was a mask and it was busting your chops. Okay. What did we do to create this soul-sucking monstrosity that is the model that we have? Why are we here?
It's a really good question. I think with many, many layers. I think the first layer is, in part, it's in our nature. I mean, we look at the history of humanity, conquering, power, greed, fear. It is how money and power have been attained. It's used, one, because it's effective. If you have more power, you win. It's also used because it's easy. It's a heck of a lot easier to just tell someone what to do than it is to inspire them to do the thing that you want them to do. But the power in that is, if you inspire them, they may do things, they will likely do things that you could have never imagined asking them to do. And so that's the real power in this.
So there's power in greed, but there's more power in love.
I believe so. And I believe, you know, there are great companies out there that do this. You know, Patagonia is a good company example, and we're seeing it in our own company. And you know, one of the things I say is, if you like planes, boats, cars, and houses, that's great. I like fun toys as well.
You got a piano,
exactly.
There you go.
In fact, you can have more of them, leading with love. And there was a Gallup study that was released recently that globally, $9.7 trillion. That's 9% of the global GDP, $9.7 trillion of productivity loss due to employee disengagement globally. So this is real money that people are leaving on the table because employees are disengaged. And we see numbers like, you know, 70, 80% of Americans disengaged at work. It's because of the system. And so it starts at the human level, was your question. We use it because it's easy. It's a lot easier than love. And we, you know, we had the Jack Welch era in the 1980s where Jack Welch was really put on a pedestal and written about in Harvard Business Review and Forbes and the Wall Street Journal, and was praised, and then sent proteges out into the Fortune 500 to run companies the same way that he did. And in fact, one of his proteges was one of my CEOs early in my career. And so I have direct experience with the Jack Welch lineage. That experience had a profound impact on how I think about leadership. So that's why we do it. I think it's in our nature. It's easier than love. And at the end of the day, it has been put on a pedestal. The biggest practitioner of this, I think, was Jack Welch. And we built a whole culture in corporate America around fear and greed. Fire the bottom 10% every single year and deliver for shareholders at all costs, which is important, right? I work for a publicly traded company. We have to deliver for shareholders. I think the better way of doing it is through love, not fear.
Okay, so we now understand, and I agree with you, and we could debate about that for a long time, different ways or reasons. The more important question is, you identified that it works. You also identified that it's easy. And you said that love is more powerful. And the reason specifically it's more powerful isn't because it's squishy and feels good. It's because it inspires people to go above and beyond, to be creative, to lift, to reciprocate, to do things for others. It enhances both energetically and in a productivity vein people's being. If people love coming to work, they show up awake. They don't have to have 17 cups of coffee, and they don't have to be pushed into this. I mean, you know, they come, like your lady said, I like it. I'm here because I want to be here. Yeah. And so there is an unlocked 10% at a minimum to be had without even trying. So since that's true, what's our first step in dismantling, inciting, or inviting a new model?
I think the ultimate step is to change CEOs' minds. You know, you think about the numbers. Amazon, not a company that's led with love. And they have 1.5 million employees. If you could change one man's mind, the CEO of Amazon, you could change the lives of 1.5 million people. The Fortune 500 employs 31 million people. 5% or 25 CEOs employ, on average, 1.5 million people. It's the same as Amazon. So look, CEOs are kings and queens. It's not, as we said earlier, you don't have full control because your people still have sovereignty over what they do in many, many ways. But as a leader, you can dictate policy. You can dictate who sits in what seats. You set the tone for every single meeting that you walk into. And so if we want to really have a profound impact on the broader world, it starts with getting CEOs on board with this philosophy.
So you're doing that. You're modeling that, and you're demonstrating a significant increase in both things that would translate into retention and attendance and productivity and bottom line cash and things like that. I don't know. And so this is just a curiosity question. You have 20 years of experience. You use that experience to build a model and are living proof of that model in terms of implementation. Do you have a thought, a plan, or a process besides having the company, and I'm not saying you need to, I'm just curious, to cause that larger change to first be examined and explored and then eventually implemented?
What's the question, Kellen? I'm sorry.
Are you going to do something with this?
How am I going to do with this? What am I going to do with this?
Sorry, that was a convoluted way of saying you learned it, you've implemented it. So what are you, and I don't care if you do or don't. I was just wondering if you have a plan to make something happen with it in a larger sense.
Yeah, my goal is, you know, I came back to corporate America because I wanted to do things differently. I got the opportunity to do that. And It's been so fulfilling, the rewards from doing this with my company and seeing what's possible. I do have a bigger purpose, Kellen. I didn't write a book just for myself. I could have kept it and just read it myself. I wrote a book because I want to show the world that there's a different way. And I want to change the minds of CEOs. I want to be on podcasts talking about this. I want to be talking on stages. I want to share this message. I want to do what I can to support other CEOs in adopting this philosophy. And so, yeah, I do have a plan. It starts with the book, and it starts and continues with conversations like this one. With the ultimate goal, I'll say, you know, I have big aspirations and big ambitions. I would love to see millions of lives changed by a switch to leadership through love rather than fear.
Okay, so I want to say to the listeners, if you have shows or opportunities, Robbie's going to change the way your company feels when you go work in it. And if you have an opportunity to allow that to happen, this guy wrote the book. So, Robbie, what didn't I ask you that's on your heart to leave with the audience to both either encourage them or to love them or to help them believe this isn't a flash in the pan, that it is truly part of, and it's not the only part. People can feel there's a global sort of energetic shift brewing, and this is an important piece of it. Is there anything else you need to tell us that I didn't ask you about?
No, this may just be a recap of some of the things, but you know, really, Kellen, my message is to the 27-year-old version of myself, the 35-year-old version of myself, and now the 42-year-old version of myself, there is a better way. If you're in the system and you feel like connection with other humans and feelings and emotions and well-being, if you think these things are important and you're in systems that that say these things aren't important and the only thing that really matters is your performance, I want people to know that that's not true. Those things are important, and there are leaders that exist that lead this way. And you should not settle for something that dehumanizes you and degrades you. And it's easier said than done. It's, you know, I spent 20 years looking for it and decided to create it, right? So it's easier said than done, but it does exist. And you know, to the 27-year-old version of me who regretted getting a Harvard MBA less than 4 months after getting it because of the system I was in and the things I was seeing and experiencing, to that version of myself, I want to say it's okay. There's a better way. There are other ways of doing this, and you can be a part of that change. And that's my message to your audience, Kellen, is that every single one of you can be a part of this change. You can change the way that you show up on your team, even if you're not a leader, even if you're an individual contributor. Your nervous system, the way that you show up, impacts that of those around you. And so this book is relevant for you. It's relevant for CEOs. Yeah, that's what I would close with, Kellen, other than letting people know how to find the book.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So the last question is, if people want some more Robbie, where do they go? Where do they find the book? Where do they find out more about other things you may have written or things that you're planning? Where do they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn and on Facebook, Robbie Humble. And you can Google Robbie Humble, and the first page that shows up should be my website, robbiehumble.com. Very important. It's Robbie with a Y, not with an IE. So go to Robbie Humble, Robbie with a Y, robbiehumble.com, and you can learn more about what I'm all about. You can get on my mailing list. And the book launch is officially happening on March 20th. But for folks that get on my mailing list between now and March 20th, they'll get access to a digital copy of the book and early access to buy the paperback book. So check out my website if you want to learn more. Click on the link to join the mailing list, and we'll make sure you get the information you need to get early editions. And then, of course, you'll be on the list for updates and you know, thought leadership.
So, Robbie, I want to thank you for taking time to share your experience, your heart, your love, your conviction, and a clear and powerful voice that change in this system is possible.
Thank you, Kellen. Such a pleasure.
So, listeners, I want you to take a moment here. Here you have a Harvard-trained, live-in-the-system, do-all-the-right-stuff guy that went and did it all and realized it's broken. It's sad. It hurts. It's extractive. It's painful. And it doesn't need to stay that way. The time is right. The possibilities are now. And whether you start leading yourself, which is where you have to start anyway, even if that's the only leadership responsibility you have, it really isn't. Because when you fill yourself with that energy of love and of growth, it leaks, it infects, it spreads, it touches everyone around you. And I know that. That's how I live. That's how Robbie lives. And I know that when we do that, it will be fun, it will be joyful, and it will help you create your ultimate life.
You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.